This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashton. All this week, we're peering 10 years into the future, looking at our unsettled world to see where we're headed. Tonight, taking the long view on globalization and the global economy. First, wavering international support for the war in Afghanistan, even as President Bush tried yesterday to expand the video Central and Eastern European leaders. Opinion polls from Russia to Spain show that America is losing public sympathy. The Washington Post's Kevin Sullivan has been collecting comments from citizens all over the world. I spoke to him earlier from Havana about the results of his informal survey.
What we found wasn't really great news for the Bush administration at this point. In Mexico City, they did a wonderful thing. A week ago, they set up an altar for their Day of the Dead outside the U.S. Embassy. But the people who came made it very clear they were there to express their sympathy for the people who died on September 11th, not to support the bombing. Mm-hmm. In fact, they were quite clear that, you know, as one woman said, we just think the government of President Bush has gone too far. This scares us. And Mexicans have traditionally not liked any sort of military confrontation outside their borders, and they don't like this one.
What did you find in Europe?
Well, the numbers there are very, very soft. While national leaders continue to support the effort, people on the streets in countries all across Europe are saying that as time goes by and the bombing goes on, they're less and less likely to support it. In France, the support is down to about 51% of the people, and it was at 66% a couple of weeks ago. In Germany, 65% of the people want the attacks to end, and in Spain, it's 69%. And even in Great Britain, the support is down to 62%.
Give us a flavor for what people are saying there.
People all over the world are saying very much the same thing. In China, for example, you see how this thing has eroded over time. We talked to someone on the street in Beijing, and this person had actually gone to a candlelight vigil for the victims of September 11th shortly after that happened. But now, he says, I supported the military strikes at first, but now I just don't know what to say. I keep hearing about civilians and children being killed, and with all America's high technology, how can this be happening? The United States should be able to do better than this.
So it's the issue of civilian deaths that really keeps coming up.
Right. There's a prominent Irish author named Tim Pat Coogan, who may be familiar to some of your listeners, who said, even in Ireland, the basic pro-American sentiment still exists, of course, but people are growing increasingly uneasy as they see these pictures of women and children and civilians being killed in Afghanistan. And this is not a question of naivete. Mr. Coogan says that, we know that many of these pictures are Taliban propaganda. That can't be helped. We're smart enough to figure that out for ourselves, but the United States is missing its targets over there, clearly. We hear all about these American smart bombs and special forces and modern electronic devices. Where are they? He says the Americans seem to be making a mess of their campaign, and he says it's starting to remind him a little bit of Vietnam.
What about Russia, Africa?
Well, in Russia, it's exactly the same thing. Vladimir Putin has been such a strong supporter, but the people on the streets and even in the parliament are saying that they're getting more and more worried about this. What they see there is the United States coming in and possibly making a huge mess in its backyard, right in its Central Asian sphere of influence. And they're afraid what's going to happen is that the Americans are going to drop the bombs and then walk away and leave the Russians to clean up the mess. And they're terrified of that.
Africa?
And in Africa, it's sort of a mixed bag. In Kenya, where there's a very large Muslim population, we found actually quite strong support for the bombing. There had been some demonstrations there that had turned violent, but things seem to be offset really by the president's strong support of the United States. But in South Africa, it seemed to be quite a different story. People there, they hear echoes of colonialism and racism, and they remember what the British did in Africa. They remember the colonial era. They remember the United States backing some of the worst leaders that Africa has produced in efforts that really killed many, many Africans. And people there remember this, and they say that the United States considers a death of a white person a casualty, but it's the death of a black African or someone of Central Asian or Indian descent, it doesn't seem quite so much like a casualty.
Kevin, you're speaking to us tonight on the job in Cuba, traditionally no great friend of the United States, but had expressed sympathy in the wake of September 11th.
They have. Cuba has, I guess, what can be best described as a cute position on this. President Fidel Castro has been very clear in saying that he condemns terrorism in all its forms. He condemned the September 11th attacks. And the Cuban government has actually offered a lot of support to the United States, and they offered to let planes land at the Havana airport during those first few hours. And they've offered other kinds of support, which have all been turned down. But partly the reason that they've been turned down is that they have been offered like this. We would love to help you because we know what it's like to be the victims of terrorism because you've been doing it to us for 40 years. It's terrible. We understand what this is like, so we have great sympathy for you, so we want to help. But in fairness to the Cubans, they really haven't made too much political hay out of this. And I think among the Cuban people, I've been talking to a lot of them, there really is authentic, genuine, and deep sorrow for what happened in the United States, because many of these people have relatives, friends, and deep cultural connections to the United States.
Kevin, what do you think of the...
are absolutely strongly against the bombing in Afghanistan.
What do you think are the implications of this souring support for the bombing? If you're sitting in Washington, what should you make of this, and how might it inform policy?
I don't know. I think this is important information. I think when you look at your evening news and you see world leader after world leader showing up at the White House to say we support you, you have to remember that that governments don't always represent the sympathy on the streets in their country. And I think in this very, very difficult situation, the United States needs to understand that leaders around the world, when they come, they're not expressing the full support of their people necessarily.
Kevin Sullivan is the Washington Post's Mexico bureau chief. He spoke with me earlier today from Havana. Economists plotting global trends say it's clear the world is getting wealthier. Middle classes across the world are seeing higher levels of financial wealth, and new trade opportunities are bringing more and more countries onto the global highway. But globalization is also bringing vulnerabilities, disruptions, hard-to-ignore inequities, and in some quarters, deep bitterness. Tonight we're taking the long view and asking, will America's new war on terror speed up globalization by creating new relationships between countries who hardly knew each other before September 11th? Or will it encourage countries to turn inward, to isolate themselves if necessary, to protect their own? And what about the millions, billions, that struggle with poverty in a globalizing world? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us in the studio tonight is Professor John Edmonds from Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. He's an expert in international finance and author of the book, The Wealthy World, The Growth and Implications of Global Prosperity. Welcome, John Edmonds.
Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. And with us in the studio tonight is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
John Edmonds, let's start off with the new starting point, 9/11. We're going to look way into the future, but start there for us, if you will. Were the September 11th attacks somehow the fruit of globalization? How do anger and globalization intersect?
Well, you could certainly say that. The growth of financial wealth has been quite conspicuous and has produced a distribution of wealth that is considerably more skewed than it was at any time in the past.
So do you see lines that get drawn there? It's not only about money, I suppose. It's also about how that integrated economy takes one culture into the face of another and maybe unsettles it.
Well, people worry more about long-distance exploitation and losing control over their own economy. Mm-hmm. And that could produce resentment.
So there we have it. The towers come down, symbol of the U.S. economy and maybe of globalization itself in a way. Do you fear that the events of September 11th may slow down or end globalization? Is there any possibility of that? Or if not, will it go forward in a different way?
Oh, I don't see any change in the trends for globalization. I think it would continue. There would be a greater emphasis on security and sealing borders to people, perhaps, but not any trends in the financial markets or the transportation of goods and services. On the subject of the towers, I really was baffled as to why that was the point of attack. They should more likely have attacked a few fiber optics cables.
Why do you say that?
Well, their argument seems to be with an abstraction, something about capitalism or globalization or U.S. dominance. And to me, buildings don't represent that.
But fiber optics cables are the means by which the world is increasingly threaded together.
Well, not only that, but also the fiber optics brings the images that challenge them and threaten their value systems.
The other thing we see here is almost an irony that only a few days after September 11th, there were huge demonstrations scheduled to protest globalization in Washington, D.C. Those, of course, didn't happen. But the big story before September 11th were these anti-globalization protests we saw all over the world. Do you think that is a permanent fixture of the globalizing economy, the globalizing era, or is that somehow knocked off its feet by the events of September?
Oh, no, I would see that continuing at its present level of intensity. I don't see that it would make that much difference in the trends that I'm looking at, which would be increasing value of financial assets and increasing world trade and decreasing sovereignty or control over national economies.
Okay, so take up the long view challenge for us. Look out 10 years. Give us a range here. If globalization goes well, and please define for us what you mean by well, where could we be? Where should we be in 10 years with it?
The good scenario, from my point of view, would be a rising standard of living for the bottom half of the income distribution of the people on the planet. That seems to me actually quite likely looking at macroeconomic aggregates, because we have slowing population growth and we also have a continuing rise in the value of financial assets.
That's the good scenario. It doesn't exactly jive with what we saw in the 90s, where at least the growing wealth that we were most aware of seemed concentrated in the first world. Is that a misperception?
Well, there was, of course, an increase in intensification of distribution of wealth, but the controversial data is whether the bottom half benefited, and I think probably it did because of the rising standard of living in India and China. Those would dominate the statistics. But if you take out India and China and consider the rest of the world, then it's probably a different picture. But I don't think that would continue.
And why not? What's changing?
I actually see a world labor shortage developing over the next 10 to 20 years.
Which means that people all over the world will be pulled more directly, more profitably into the global economy?
Well, they'd be pulled into the world economy, they'd be pulled into the money economy, and they'd become possibly the owners of financial assets. But more obviously than that, there would be rising wages.
So if things go well, you're looking at what kind of gains by the poorest portion of the world's population over the next decade?
Well, we're talking about people who make $2 a day. That might go up to $5 a day and without inflation.
And give us a sense in terms of lifestyle. What will that mean to those folks? You know, in the U.S. terms, that's a big deal. But Cambodia?
Very noticeable. If you've traveled in rural areas in the third world, you've seen people who are living on $1 or $2 a day, and you see the difference it makes in their life when they're living on $5 a day. They suddenly can afford things like cooking oil and rice instead of having to eat root crops.
So you see globalization as inexorable. It just won't be stopped.
Well, it won't be stopped by anything that I see happening right now. And I don't know any way of stopping it, really, that is likely to happen.
What makes it inexorable?
I see it as the aspirations of middle-class people to provide for their own retirement and to provide for their own future security. So they save through the financial system, and that puts tremendous pressure on managers to deliver returns.
Jack Beatty, this is a pretty rosy view of globalization.
Yeah, the question, I guess, is whether this will happen just through the invisible hand or whether more intervention is needed to bring about the outcome you're talking about, rising living standards for the bottom half. I think that's the debate about globalization. No one is really saying stop it. I think the question is, how far should it go? It's somewhat ironic that the capitalism that we have been exporting is not the capitalism we practice here. We practice a capitalism here that has environmental safeguards, that has a minimum wage, that has working standards, that has all manner of benefits that we say, well, we can't negotiate those or even simulacro of those with other countries because that will interfere in the gears of globalization. So do you think that without any sort of intervention of the world community to set standards that just the labor shortage alone will be enough to...
John Edmund,
we're going to hold that question.
We'll hold that question. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking this evening with Professor John C. Edmonds. He's professor of finance at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. He's an expert on international finance in emerging markets. We're looking at globalization and the global economy. How's it surviving September 11th? And looking way out, taking the long view, what does it portend for the world 10 years from now? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Are you ready to put your faith in globalization? Do you have a choice? Call us or join us online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the global economy, taking the long view of globalization and asking, where might globalization be in 10 years? How will we handle the stresses and strains that it produces on world cultures and national economies? What's your level of confidence in globalization? Is it inevitable? And if it is, should we do it differently? Is there a better way than we've done in the last decade or two? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has suggested that there might be a better way, that there might be improvements in the way we pursue or understand globalization. He spoke last month on the subject at the Labour Party convention in the UK.
If globalization works only for the benefit of the few, then it will fail, and it will deserve to fail. But if we follow the principles that have served us here so well at home, that power, wealth, and opportunity must be in the hands of the many, not the few, if we make that our guiding light for the global economy, then it will be a force for good and an international movement we should take pride in leading.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking last month at the Labour Party convention. We're joined this hour by John C. Edmonds. He's professor of finance at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. He's an expert on international finance and emerging markets. Professor Edmonds, you've seen third world poverty firsthand. It's not just an abstraction. Tell us about what you've seen and the impact you see globalization having had on those realms of poverty. As it sometimes made it worse, as it overall made it better, or is the real upside still to come? Where are we in all that?
Well, I'd say the real upside is still to come. I worked in the third world for about 10 years, and I've seen the little children with the swollen tummies and so on, and it's really quite distressing. And a lot of what I tried to do was to make their lives better off. I feel much better now about their prospects than I did at that time, because what I'm seeing is a high-powered invisible hand, different from the growth by trade that we used to have. Instead, now I see a financial wealth propagation mechanism that is much more powerful and would pull those people more quickly into the money economy, into the service economy, into getting educated and into having a wider world.
Elaborate on that for us. What do you mean by a more powerful invisible hand in the financial economy?
Well, when I was working in economic development, the driving principle was something about altruism or charity or helping people who weren't so advantaged. But now this is a process driven much more by self-interest.
It's not foreign aid at the bottom of it.
No, in fact, foreign aid flows have been diminishing, and I don't find that particularly distressing because I see international capital flows, particularly portfolio investment, moving into countries to buy financial assets that are yielding higher rates of return. What we had for quite a while was a shortage of financial assets, and that produced a very high price of stocks and some bonds. Now what we have is a more moderate market with market prices of securities being much more reasonable because the new issuance of securities is keeping pace with the demand.
But when do those financial institutions begin to lift boats in Afghanistan?
Well, they wouldn't in Afghanistan, not for quite some time, but the part of the world that I'm the most familiar with, Latin America, I'm seeing national pension systems that are bringing financial assets to people making as little as $300 or $400 a month. People at the lower edge of the middle class are now getting substantial accumulation of savings for retirement, and they're earning very high rates of return on those over long periods of time.
Jack Beattie, you asked about do we need more than the invisible hand, and John Edmonds says, well, this is a new kind of invisible hand. It's really strong. It gets in there and it lifts things. Are you ready to hitch our star to that?
Well, I'm skeptical, I guess. That didn't happen here. The invisible hand did not bring about our current democratic prosperity. We needed government intervention. We needed the New Deal. And not only did that create more equity, it created more economic balance. It gave people money to buy things. Wages went up. Unions were plentiful. You know, there's a trend. I mean, we've seen it although in general, nations exposed to trade, and you know these statistics much better than I do, their per capita income has gone up. Yet the difference between the richest nations and the poorest nations is sharper now than it has been in a long time. And that's really tracked by what's happened here in the United States. I mean, in the 1950s, when we were in the 60s, when we were not exposed to international trade to speak of. In the 50s, real wages went up 37%. In the 60s, 41%. Since 1973, since the moment when the Arab oil boycott introduced us to the world economy, real wages in America have gone up 7 1/8%, a little bit more since 95, and most of that has gone to the top 20%. So yes, lots of wealth has been created, but the distribution has produced a society that is much less equal than the one we had in the 1960s.
We're talking about globalization and the global economy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Do you believe that the global economy is going to bring prosperity? Do you believe it brings justice, happiness? Will it ever bring equity? Does that matter? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Professor John Edmonds, Jack Beatty is saying we've got a bigger than ever gap between the richest and the poorest countries. Do you accept that? And attribute it to globalization somehow?
Oh, certainly, yes. Let's consider an individual emerging country when financial transformation occurs. The money hits the capital city first, so you get a divergence between the income level in the capital city and the hinterland within the emerging country itself. You also get an immediate intensification of the divergence between rich and poor in those countries, which is already very large in the first place. Referring to the recent history in the U.S., mm-hmm. It's not just the top 20% that have benefited. You could even say the top 1% or the top 0.1% have reaped most of the gains. But then if you look at total job creation and standards of living, there have been widespread benefits. And we could debate the data about the bottom half, but the top half, I think, unambiguously in the U.S. has become better off. So what we've seen is a diffusion from a very rapidly rising peak. And that's what I think we are seeing. And I don't see, you're quite right, any government intervention that is actually doing anything in the emerging countries or including in the other OECD countries that would moderate that.
Yeah, Robert Reich, for example, suggests an IMF that would condition loans on investments in education and social infrastructure rather than in fiscal austerity. I mean, that would be a policy change, wouldn't it, that would increase social capital in these countries?
Well, yes, there have been de facto policies of trying to condition international loans on various types of behavior in the individual countries, and that's not really new. I remember one in the 1970s, about one quarter of the bank lending had to go to agriculture, otherwise the banks would lose their license and so on. But in general, those haven't been very effective because there's always a way to circumvent it, or there's always a country that is offering high-yielding finance paper that doesn't require that.
So, John Edmonds, if we sort of gave globalization a checkup right now, what's working? What's not? Does it need a tune-up? Are there things we could do to make it work better, to perhaps make it produce equity, a little more equity, a little more quickly?
I'd like to see some of that. I think we're in a stage of prototype capitalism similar to the early days of the Industrial Revolution in England, when there was a massive shift in income and wealth, but appalling conditions for certainly the first 20 and possibly the first 50 years. We may be somewhere around year 20 of that similar transformation right now.
So in layman's terms, how would you tweak the system, or more than tweak it?
I don't have any preference for any of the remedies that have been proposed. For example, a Tobin tax, which is a tax on international transactions, would be very hard to put into effect. And conditioning IMF loans on particular types of behavior by the countries that are receiving them is already being done, and I don't know really how much more the IMF could do, because after all, they don't really move that much money. When you look at the total world financial assets of $100 trillion, heading rapidly, by the way, toward $200 trillion, which is my personal estimate for 6 or 7 years from now, that's really an enormous amount of money compared to the amount that the IMF can possibly muster.
Let's bring our callers into the conversation. We're talking about globalization. We're taking the long view tonight, looking at the global economy and how it's evolving. Are we feeling comfortable with the way it's headed and what it can do for the world, or do we fear that it may bring more problems? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Will is on the line. Welcome, Will. You're on the air.
Hi. I lived and worked in Egypt for about 10 years, and when it was sort of the Middle East equivalent of an Asian tiger. Mm-hmm. And just listening to the conversation and talking about, well, the income distribution between the rich countries and the poor countries, developed and undeveloped. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, when you look at the income distribution in a place like Egypt, which has had amazing growth over the last 10 years, it is incredibly shallow. I mean,
What do you mean by shallow, Will?
Well, it means that the top 0.1% of the country has reaped maybe 99% of the benefits. Mm-hmm. In actual real terms, from my understanding, the actual income has gone down for the rest of the country, but the top percentage, it's just been going up and up ridiculously high. I mean, Cairo is very disturbing when you go there and people, you know, donkey carts and people in Ferrari.
Yeah, we hear that again and again. It's a great point. Let us put it to John Edmonds, Will. And this relates really back to Jack Beatty's point. The United States had in part, the New Deal to kind of get the field leveled enough that everybody could feel part of it. We see other countries that don't have governments who have the capacity or maybe the inclination at all to do that. Even if globalization works, if it doesn't filter out through these inequitable national systems, is it not still a powder keg?
Oh, it certainly could be, and I would certainly agree with a caller on the subject of the distribution of gains from growth in Egypt. For me, the big difference between Egypt and the U.S. is a key element of the New Deal for me was the Securities and Exchange Commission that required financial markets to have full disclosure and equal treatment and level the playing field. And then at that point, ordinary people could invest in the financial assets and not lose everything, whereas in most of the world, there is no such protection for investors.
Will, what do you think? Would an Egyptian SEC solve the problem there?
No. I mean, it's a definite start because the stock market is kind of a joke there. That would be a start, definitely. But I mean, we have to add this back into what's happened recently, and the fact that, you know, in a place like Egypt, when I was there, was there was a lot of fundamentalist activity, and it was people who were not getting anywhere in the system that reverted to this kind of political action.
Right, Will, you're breaking up on us, but let us put that point also to John Edmonds.
Yes.
What is the effect on these radical ideologies on the playing out of globalization? Does it retard, warp somehow the effect that you anticipate of globalization in such a way that it may not play out as we anticipate?
I would say it puts more pressure on the governments to develop institutions similar to what we got after the New Deal, because otherwise it creates people who are seeing right next to them a lifestyle that they will never have, and the radical religion appeals more for that reason, perhaps.
But it's more clear than ever that this globalization of the next decade is not going to take place on a placid sea. It's stormy weather out there. What's the effect of that?
Well, it could be quite turbulent. I look for quite choppy financial markets and also quite choppy commodities markets. But if you look at the index of commodity prices, it's been going straight down for the last several years, but really for the last 20 years.
Meaning
that the prices of most standard technology goods are just getting cheaper and cheaper. And so the traditional exit from poverty was to produce something and do it better. And that isn't working. So instead, what countries have to do is they have to improve their financial infrastructure so that they can issue securities and claims on assets, claims on cash flows that would be valuable.
It sounds like it may be a tall order for some of the countries we've been hearing a lot about lately, but we'll see. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Professor John Edmonds, taking the long view of globalization and the global economy. Miranda is on the line. Welcome, Miranda. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I am calling to talk about the big gap that everybody is talking about between the top 1% and the rest of the population. I think something that is missing quite a bit in the conversation is what is missing now in the world, the middle class. Let me give you a little bit of my background. I grew up in Macau, a very small peninsula next to Hong Kong, and we have seen tremendous change in the economy. And one of the biggest things that I believe we experienced was the middle class and also a very strong commercial law system that took a very strong
So what's your concern now, Miranda? What's your concern now?
My concern now is that with all the talk in all these troubled nations that I'm looking at, there is very little distinction between the ruler who are in power and the top 1% that is getting rich. So the invisible hand is going to work for them to keep getting richer, but who is there to counter the balance?
Thank you for your call, Miranda. Miranda's from Macau. Macau, like Hong Kong, has been absorbed into China, and then we know how the sort of ruling elite in China are also very involved in a lot of business at many levels now and have accumulated a lot of wealth. Here again, we have a caller raising the kind of wrinkles that imperfections in systems introduced to the sort of ideal model of globalization.
Yeah, I would distinguish the real wealth from financial wealth, and also I do regret the loss of the middle class. Many middle class people fell back into poverty because they were producing standard technology manufactured goods. Years ago, I used to pay $29 for an electric heater. Now I'm getting them for $9.95. And it's the same electric heater, and it's after many years of inflation, although not very much inflation. So it's obviously costing me less. And so whoever was making that heater is much worse off. And the difficulty that I see is how to stop the mechanism that we are seeing right now without simply diverting it into another part of the world. In other words, if a country says, in order to invest in this country, you have to do the things on this list, then the money just migrates somewhere else.
But that argues for international standards.
Yes, it does. Yes, yes.
That basically says, wait a minute, we're all going to go forward together, and when we make these free trade deals, they're going to be stipulations. They're going to be stipulations about minimum wages, working conditions, the whole lot. Isn't that the answer to the capital flight question?
Well, the stipulation that I would impose is something that in something I'm writing right now, I'm calling the tequila penalty. The tequila name is applied to the Mexican financial crisis that broke out in December of 1994 and not only impoverished large numbers of people in Mexico, but really hurt portfolio investors, including people of fairly modest means who had bought Mexican securities. Not to pick on any one country, many countries have done this, but that was the first time that it was really generating a sense of outrage. And I would propose a series of rules that could actually be put into effect where penalties would be assessed on governments that mishandle the financial system.
Who would assess the penalties?
Well, it could be assessed by the UN or the World Bank or the WTO or the IMF, or it could be assessed by the Club of Paris. Right now it's being assessed by a different phenomenon called Mr. Market. Mm-hmm. Mr. Market is this very powerful consensus of middle-class investors who just don't buy that stuff anymore, and that's really devastating. It's much worse than the penalty that I'm proposing.
So you don't think that globalization has to be laissez-faire?
No, quite the contrary. I just don't see any really organized force right now that would put something into effect.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking about globalization, taking the long view. Where's the global economy going to be in 10 years? What are the prospects? What are the possibilities? You can join the conversation. Call 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can get a primer on globalization with frequently asked questions. Going to our website, log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This hour, we're taking the long view of globalization, the global economy. We're talking tonight with Professor John Edmonds. He's professor of finance at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. John Edmonds says that globalization is going to happen, and it's going to work. It's going to create and spread wealth. How much confidence do you feel in that? Are you ready to put your hands, your lives, your pocketbook, into a globalized system? Do we have any choice about it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Partha is on the line. Welcome, Partha. You're on the air.
Thank you. I think there are three points I'd like to make, which has been a favorite point of mine for a while.
Okay.
The first one is that the globalization is a word who are limited to those individuals who can perceive the globe. And obviously, it is limited to 10% of the population, because often in poor countries, the 80% even do not know the next village forget globalization. That's point number one.
Okay.
So they're basically serving the need of one very, very small sector.
Yep. Give us the other two real quick.
The second point, very quickly, is that as the previous callers have been indicating, I have lived in India, Malaysia, Turkey, and China. But keeping China aside, in most of the countries, globalization has only benefited the top 0.1% of the population, whereas the 99% have stayed in the sidelines.
Okay, and third?
And the third, which is most important, the governments of these countries, in trying to be popular with developed countries, they end up basically serving the developed country vocabulary. And in the process, the 80% of the population where poverty resides have not been represented at all. So I think we need a framework which would help people truly understand the bottom 80% of the global population, and which does not exist today.
Partha, thanks. Let's put that to John Edmonds, and there are, you know, several points there. You heard them. First of all, Partha says, if you don't perceive the globe, you don't benefit from globalization. Do you agree?
Well, I would say that some people could benefit from globalization even without traveling, but it certainly is true that people's horizons are already widening, first of all, because of access to media. They see TV programs, and they see soap operas, and they see how the people live elsewhere, and then a lot of their own choices then change subsequent to that.
And it only benefits the top 1%, a recurring theme here.
Well, you could certainly say that so far, and particularly in the countries that he mentioned, where, again, it's a production-based economy where there aren't that many families that own the means of production, and they don't actually have necessarily that much pressure on them to distribute the benefits. And they may have some leverage over people to compel them to work, and that gets back to the supply of labor, which I think is actually slowing down. I was looking at some data earlier today, and the consensus forecast for world population is that it would grow at 1% a year over the next 25 years, and then only 0.5% a year for the 25 after that.
The implication being?
It would produce a labor shortage fairly quickly, and I think what will actually happen is the labor shortage would occur sooner.
But the labor shortage will happen in the developed world. Well, there's a differential here. There's a population boom, isn't there, in the third world?
No, actually, the population boom is not uniform throughout the third world. There's actually quite a major discrepancy of growth rates from one country to the next, even within the same zone. Mm. It's quite a different phenomenon from what I thought when I really started looking at the data. Mm-hmm.
And part of the third point, and part of the thank you for your call, but was that the upper tier of these developing economies adopts the vocabulary of the developed world, reaps the benefits, and then somehow this seems to me maybe goes back to September 11th, that
yes.
What if
yeah.
globalization's benefits don't pass through quickly enough when, as you say, media are increasingly showing the lower
yes.
portion of the economic scale, what's going on up there in the affluent, prosperous plans? Doesn't that breed a kind of anger that could be destructive to this entire system, maybe even bring it down?
It certainly could. You can see intensification of the contrast even while people at the bottom are becoming better off. Also, the point you mentioned that the governments of many emerging countries are becoming much too obedient to the demands of if you will, the Washington consensus or Mr. Market. That is also true, and they are frequently criticized for it. But at the moment, where we are in this financial wealth dynamic, they don't really have that much choice, because there was a president of Brazil who said maybe 8 or 10 years ago, the economic policy of Brazil will not be set by the stock market. So the stock market went down 10% the next day.
Take that, Brazil.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't anyone that did it. It just happened.
Mm-hmm. That's the market.
Yeah.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ted is on the line. Welcome, Ted.
Hi. Hi. I was wondering, when I was growing up, it was like through all the economic classes and everything, we were always told that the small shopkeepers, the small factories and business owners of those, you know, small shops had a profound influence on how our community was formed and how it grew up, and, you know, determining street patterns, laws, all sorts of things.
We remember.
And now what I see is, like in my hometown, if I look down Main Street, I realize that most of these are franchises that have the shopkeepers, they no longer have, the owners no longer have a tie to the community. Their strongest ties to the parent corporation in some far-off place.
Do you connect that to the globalization of the economy, Ted?
What I'm wondering about is, like, if you go to Moscow or other places where you see emerging markets, immediately people like CVS, Dunkin' Donuts, McDonald's are quickly trying to get into those markets because they have to expand, they have to keep their stockholders happy. But I'm wondering, is that going to have a bad influence on these growing communities where they won't have the time to have the small shopkeepers and the small factories? Those owners have an influence on how government is made, and what they'll have is franchise owners from large corporations coming from various places. Mm.
Ted, thanks for your questions. I'm sorry. Let me put it. Our time is running down. Let me put it to John Edmonds. Is when we open up these networks, these pathways, is it just going to be the big corporations who flow out and harvest the fruits?
I would make the point, even in more general terms, that small business, including agriculture and any rural fabric of society, is threatened by financial global pressures. And the caller is quite right to mention the stock prices of these companies, because that's what they're really trying to do. They're really trying to raise their stock price. So they will expand internationally if that would make their stock go up. And what that can do is they can go into a town and they can kill off five or six retailers in a few weeks.
Jack Beattie, John Edmonds describes, on the one hand, a picture of potential enormous prosperity and globalization really fueling that. And at the same time, we all see the potential obstacles to that and how human emotion and dissatisfaction over inequities at any given moment can lead to real outbursts, maybe even issues of peace and war.
Yeah, and you know that's a sort of negative of this, but you know it's also a negative of a possible positive. Just before the First World War, British economist Norman Angell wrote a book, The Great Illusion. To him, the Great Illusion was war was possible because world trade made the interdependence made it possible. Impossible. Well, we realize that he had the illusion, but of course, world trade has only now reached the level it had in 1913, and so someone like me that comes along and said, "Well, isn't globalization the hope for peace?" Sounds like a pangloss. And yet, I have to think that after an age of nationalism, when the nation state has killed millions, an era where the nation state weakens and money making becomes the main activity of the planet, does a hope for interdependence mean more peace, or does this kind of ruction from the bottom, where people aren't sharing in it, does that mean more instability? How would you look at it?
Well, I hate to say it, but I'm not really hopeful for world peace because of trade. I'm hopeful for world peace because the value of financial assets could become as much as 11 times the value of output. And the value of financial assets fluctuates so much more when there's any disruption that disruption is now really a bad idea. I mean, it's not just war doesn't just destroy people and property. It lowers the value of financial assets, and that's unpardonable.
But this was just the argument that Angell made. He said the Germans' banks practically own our British banks. We couldn't have war with Germany.
Well, it's an extension of this argument that any place there's a Kentucky Fried Chicken, those countries can't fight each other. Do we buy that?
No. I'm just saying that when somebody knocks the value of one of my stocks in half, then I'll do whatever I can to get back at him. But that wouldn't include picking up a gun and going over there and shooting there. I'll just buy something else.
Still, even 10 years out, it's hard to see a lot of Afghan shareholders as stakeholders in this economy.
Certainly not.
And it's hard to see how Mr. Market and Mr. Democracy get together. I mean, if they're
quite so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's the frightening part of this. Is globalization friendly to democracy, or in the kind of spike it produces between rich and poor, is it in fact hostile to the whole notion of a kind of it needs to be sort of autocratic, a kind of directed capitalism, such as we have in China?
I would say it's more on the control side. That is, it will be much more important now to know what everybody's doing and to know every time somebody crosses a border. And also the cost of storing data has dropped so dramatically that we could have a gigabyte of information on every human being in a room this size, and it wouldn't cost very much.
But it sounds like with all this opportunity, no guarantees. And this is not a process that's going to just assure economic nirvana around the world, which is kind of the wrapper that was put on globalization at points in the 90s.
And still is. You see people keep putting this gloss, just let it go. It'll produce, a new heaven and a new earth.
Tremendous power there, but no guarantees.
Somewhere down the road, but in the meantime, all the market climbs a wall of worry.
Mm.
Yeah. And we're having quite a good stock market this week. A few more weeks like this, I'll be quite happy.
In spite of all. John Edmonds, thank you so much for coming in this evening.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
John Edmonds is professor of finance at Babson College in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Jack Beattie, great to have you as always.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation and read the first chapter of John Edmonds' book, The Wealthy World, by going to our website, log on to WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage. Now, a voice from World War I. In 1917, a British soldier named Cecil Summers kept a diary so that his daughter Margaret could fit his personal story into the history of the Great War. Here's WBUR's Ian Doherty reading the opening of Cecil Summers' diary.
By the time I begin to sit up and take notice, little Margaret, people will be referring to the time when the war was on. Not be old enough to remember how the men in khaki came back and how in a few weeks they disappeared, and other men, strangely like them, but clothed in dull civvies and talking of shop or office, took their place. As you grow up, you will find that the world in which you live is full of very ordinary people. The butcher, the baker, the man who comes to see about the drains, the gardener, and your father. It will be hard for you to realise that these men and the soldiers who fought in the war are the same. They are so very ordinary, aren't they? Everybody will be leagued against you to deceive you. Your grandmother, who is apt to sentimentalise, will tell you that Daddy was a crusader. Fresh from reading the exploits of Richard Coeur de Lion, you will try to picture him in shining armour with a large red cross somewhere about him. And you will fail. Try to picture him bathing at Alexandria while the guns roar and thunder 250 miles away. I thought that would be easier. Books, too, will mislead you. The atmosphere in which heroes move is so much more enthralling and profitable than the stale tobacco of the ordinary man. Nor are you likely to get the whole truth by questioning the butcher or any of the other men of whom I've spoken. Distance leads enchantment to the view, and I'm afraid that in 10 years' time, they, like the soldiers of Henry V, will remember with advantages the deeds they did that day. The butcher, the baker, the man who comes about the drains, and the rest of them are all temporary crusaders now, whether they are in Palestine or France. But they're in every way the same men that you will know later on. And very ordinary men at that. Remember this, and when in days to come Daddy strikes Mummy because the porridge is burnt, you won't be tempted to think to yourself, how poor Father must have deteriorated since he was a crusader.
WBUR's Ian Doherty reading from the diary of Cecil Summers, a British soldier in World War I, a voice from a distant war, and a humble, distant warrior. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How's the war on terrorism or the sagging economy affecting you? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. You can listen to and read other radio diaries on our website. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.